All right, so today we're going to be taking a deep dive into a case that really kind of gets at the heart of how challenging the legal system can be, especially when we're trying to protect children. We're talking about People v. Duncan, a Michigan case that raises some really tough questions about child witness testimony when it comes to sexual abuse cases.
Absolutely. And this case really pushes us to think about how we balance the needs of these young victims with the rights of the accused.
So, to give our listeners a little bit of background, can you kind of lay out the basic facts in People v. Duncan?
Of course. The case is about the Duncans, a couple who ran an unlicensed daycare, and they were accused of criminal sexual conduct involving kids under 13.
Okay.
And one of the key witnesses in this case was a 3-year-old girl, referred to as RS in the court documents.
Wow.
And here's where things get kind of tricky. RS actually gave testimony at these pretrial hearings, and at that time, the court said she was competent to testify. But when it came time for the actual trial, she got super distressed and couldn't even answer basic questions.
Oh, wow. That must have been so hard for everyone involved.
It really was.
So how did the court end up handling that situation? Because it seems like a real dilemma having a child witness who can't testify at the actual trial.
It was a tough call for the court.
Yeah.
Initially, the trial court decided to just get rid of Aris's testimony entirely
Oh, wow.
because she just wasn't able to answer questions, and her distress on the stand was very apparent.
Yeah.
She couldn't even answer simple questions about telling the truth.
Right.
So just try to imagine a 3-year-old, put on the stand in this courtroom environment, completely overwhelmed and unable to really articulate what happened.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
It is.
But it also brings up these crucial legal questions about whether her previous statements can even be used.
Right. And that's where things get really legally interesting.
Yeah.
Right. We're talking about whether a child's earlier statements, those made outside of the courtroom, can be used if they're unable to testify at the trial.
Precisely.
So what happens next?
Well, this is where Michigan's rules of evidence really come into play, specifically MRE 601, focusing on competency.
Okay, so for those of us who aren't, legal experts, break down what competency means in this situation.
Sure. In the simplest terms, MRE 601 looks at whether a witness, and in this case a child, understands the difference between truth and lies,
No.
and whether they get the importance of telling the truth in court.
So it's not just about whether they can talk or understand language. It's about their ability to grasp the idea of truth and their duty to be truthful when they testify.
Exactly. And because RS was so young and clearly distressed, the court had big concerns about her being competent to testify, even though she had been deemed competent earlier.
Right.
It's a tough situation.
Yeah, it is. So the prosecution obviously still wanted to use her earlier statements since she couldn't testify at the trial. What were their arguments?
Well, they pointed to another part of the Michigan Rules of Evidence, MRE 804A,
Okay.
which deals with a witness being unavailable. Their argument was that RS being so distressed, directly related to her age and what she went through, should be seen as a mental infirmity.
So if the court agreed that RS was unavailable because of a mental infirmity, would that allow the prosecution to then use those statements from the pretrial hearings?
It could, yeah.
Okay.
Because those earlier statements were made under oath and she was cross-examined back then,
Right.
they could potentially be admissible because of a hearsay exception. Specifically, MRE 804B1.
Okay.
But the big question was, would the court actually accept that her distress qualified as a mental infirmity, legally speaking?
This case is like a legal maze with all these rules and exceptions. It's complicated.
It is, yeah.
So, how did the Michigan Supreme Court ultimately decide?
They sided with the prosecution.
Daily.
Yeah, in a landmark decision.
Right.
Justice Young wrote the majority opinion, and he argued that the legal system needs to be more understanding of how kids develop differently.
Right.
He basically said, we can't hold kids to the same standards as adults when it comes to dealing with the stress of a courtroom.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because think about it, a 3-year-old having to describe this traumatic experience in a courtroom.
Right.
It's almost impossible to imagine.
Yeah.
And Justice Young took it a step further and connected that idea of how kids develop to the concept of mental infirmity. He argued that a child not being able to testify because they're extremely distressed, especially distress tied to their age and the abuse, should actually fall under that legal definition.
So it's like the court was recognizing how vulnerable children are
Right.
and saying that their distress shouldn't prevent them from being heard in court.
Exactly. But it's important to note that this wasn't a unanimous decision.
Okay.
And the concurring and dissenting opinions really highlight just how complex this issue is.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask about next. There were obviously some strong opinions on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
Can you kind of walk us through those different perspectives?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So let's start with Justice Markman's concurrence.
Okay.
He agreed with the majority that RS couldn't testify, but he focused on a broader idea of unavailability.
Okay.
Not just mental infirmity specifically.
Got it.
He felt that the situation with a young child unable to testify because of distress just met the general criteria for being unavailable under MRE 804A.
So he got to the same conclusion, but kind of took a different route to get there.
Exactly.
It sounds like they all agreed that this little girl should not be forced to testify.
Yes, there was definitely a shared feeling of wanting to protect RS from more trauma.
And what about Justice McCormack?
Justice McCormack, in her concurring opinion, brought in some existing Supreme Court precedents.
Okay.
These precedents recognize that kids have unique psychological characteristics, although those cases focused on juvenile offenders, not witnesses. But she argued that these precedents back up the idea that children's brains and their emotional responses are just different from adults.
Right.
And the legal system needs to account for those differences.
So we have two concurring opinions that maybe differ a bit in their reasoning. But both support the idea that RS couldn't testify because of her distress.
Yeah.
What about the dissent, though? What was Justice Kavanaugh concerned about?
Justice Kavanaugh had a very different view.
Okay.
He was worried about expanding the definition of unavailability without clear direction from lawmakers.
Okay.
His concern was that if a child's distress can be a mental infirmity, then adults with anxiety or emotional issues might also claim unavailability.
Right.
And that could weaken a defendant's right to confront their accuser, which is a big deal in our legal system.
That's a good point. It sounds like he was worried about this ruling being applied too broadly beyond cases involving kids.
Exactly. He saw it as a potential slippery slope.
Yeah.
He also argued that allowing those earlier statements as evidence when the accuser can't be cross-examined could raise due process concerns for the accused.
So he was advocating for a more careful approach, considering the rights of the accused, along with the needs of child witnesses.
Precisely. And he specifically called for the legislature to step in and make clearer guidelines for these tough situations involving child witnesses who can't testify at trial.
So we end up with this landmark ruling with a mix of opinions.
Yeah.
The court recognized that children are uniquely vulnerable, but also grappled with what could happen if unavailability is broadened too much.
Right.
It definitely brings up a lot of questions about how the legal system should handle these really sensitive cases.
Absolutely.
What do we do now?
That's the question, isn't it? And that's exactly what we'll explore next.
Okay.
We'll look at what the Duncan ruling means in practice, how it might affect future cases, and the bigger debate it sparked about protecting both kids who are witnesses and the rights of those accused.
All right. Sounds good. So we've seen how People v. Duncan really kind of change things in Michigan, especially when it comes to child witness testimony.
Yeah.
But let's zoom out for a second. How does this case fit into the bigger picture? What does it mean for lawyers and judges who are dealing with these kinds of situations?
Well, I think one of the most important things that came out of the Duncan ruling is that it gave us a framework for looking at a child's ability to testify.
Okay.
It's not just a yes or no question of can they talk or understand language.
Yeah.
The court said it's important to think about the child's development, their emotional state, whether they can answer questions and any signs of distress they might be showing.
That seems like a much more in-depth approach than just using a basic competency test.
Right. The ruling acknowledges that just because a child might know the difference between truth and lies doesn't mean they're ready emotionally or mentally to handle being in a courtroom.
Yeah.
Especially when they've been through something traumatic.
So if a lawyer is getting a young child ready to testify in a case about abuse, how would this ruling change the way they do things?
Well, I think this case really shows how important it is to have lawyers who understand trauma and how it can affect a child.
Uh-huh.
Lawyers need to how trauma can make it hard for a child to talk about what happened and to remember things. It's about making the child feel safe and supported, using language they can understand.
Right.
And recognizing that a child might not act the way people expect a witness to act.
Yeah, that makes sense. It also seems like this ruling could have a big impact on how prosecutors put together their cases, especially in child abuse cases where the child is like the main witness.
Absolutely. By kind of expanding what mental infirmity means, the ruling could make it easier for prosecutors to use those earlier statements from child victims.
Okay.
Even if those children can't actually testify in court.
But wouldn't that make it harder for defense attorneys to fight the prosecution's case?
Right.
I mean, if the child isn't there, How can they cross-examine them and see if their statements are really reliable?
That's exactly what a lot of defense attorneys are worried about.
Right.
And it was a big part of Justice Kavanaugh's dissent. They say that this ruling could take away some of the defendant's right to confront their accuser, which is a really important part of our legal system.
It's a tough balance, right?
It is.
You want to protect these vulnerable kids and make sure they're heard, but you also have to protect the rights of the person accused.
That's right. And that's why this case has caused so much debate. There are really good arguments on both sides.
Okay, so let's talk about how other states are handling this kind of thing. Are there any other states that are doing something similar to Michigan? Or do they have completely different rules about child witness testimony?
It's a good question. It's important to remember that laws can be different from state to state.
Yeah.
So what happened in Duncan applies to Michigan, but it has definitely made other states think about this issue.
Uh-huh.
Some states have created special hearsay exceptions that only apply to kids who are witnesses.
Okay.
These exceptions recognize that kids are more vulnerable and that it can be hard for them to testify in court.
So some states have basically made special rules. They consider the things that might affect a child's ability to testify, like their development and their emotional state.
Exactly. And these exceptions usually have stricter requirements to make sure that what the child said is reliable.
Can you give us an example of what one of these child-specific hearsay exceptions might look like?
Sure. Let's say you have a 5-year-old child who tells their therapist about sexual abuse.
Okay.
In some states, what that child told their therapist might be allowed as evidence in court, even if the child can't testify because of a special hearsay exception that's meant to protect child victims.
So instead of using a broad interpretation of mental infirmity, like in the Duncan case, these states have made specific rules for kids.
Right. They've recognized that the usual rules about hearsay might not work well in child abuse cases.
Mm-hmm.
So they've changed their laws to protect children better while still trying to be fair to everyone involved.
It sounds like there's no easy answer to this.
Hmm.
It's a really complex issue with big consequences for everyone.
You're absolutely right. The Duncan case is a powerful example of how the law changes as we learn more about trauma child development and how to balance protecting victims with upholding the rights of the accused.
So what happens next? What's the future of child witness testimony, especially after Duncan? And with all these different approaches in different states, it really feels like we're at this point in the law where what we're learning about child psychology and trauma is making us rethink how we handle these really tough cases.
I totally agree. And I think that call for the legislature to get involved, which we saw in Justice Kavanaugh's dissent in Duncan, is going to be even bigger in the next few years.
Yeah, that makes sense. Legislatures are better suited than courts to come up with those clear and specific guidelines for dealing with child witness testimony, right?
Exactly.
They can really get into the details and hear from different sides and make laws that both protect children and make sure the accused gets a fair trial.
Exactly. They can hold hearings, talk to experts, and really think things through carefully.
Right. It's not something that should just be decided by court rulings one case at a time.
Right.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into People v. Duncan, what are the main things our listeners should take away? What should lawyers and judges and anyone who cares about this issue really remember about this case?
I think the biggest thing is that this ruling really changed how we think about child witness testimony in Michigan. The court said that a child's distress, especially if it's connected to trauma, can be seen as a mental infirmity under the law.
And that's a big deal, right? It's about recognizing that kids are especially vulnerable in the legal system.
Absolutely. It's about understanding that children aren't just small adults. They see the world differently, they deal with trauma differently, and we need to change our legal processes to reflect that.
It also seems like this case started a wider conversation about using prior statements, the right to confront your accuser, and the need for clear guidelines that everyone follows.
You're right. Duncan really got those conversations going. It makes us deal with some really tough questions, like how do we make sure children's voices are heard without ignoring due process? How do we balance protecting victims with the rights of the accused?
Those are tough questions with no easy answers.
Yeah.
And we'll probably be debating them for a long time.
Definitely. But I think the Duncan case, with all its complexity and different opinions, has pushed us in the right direction. It made us face the reality of child trauma and really think about how our legal system can better serve both victims and those accused of crimes.
So if our listeners want to learn more about this, where should they go? What resources would you recommend?
I would say read the whole Duncan decision and pay attention to the different opinions. It's a really interesting example of how legal precedents are made.
I'd also suggest looking at the specific child hearsay exceptions in their own states and any laws that are being proposed about child witness testimony.
And of course, keeping up with the latest research on child psychology and trauma-informed legal advocacy is important too.
Absolutely. This area of law is always changing, and it's important for legal professionals and anyone who cares about protecting children to stay involved and informed.
Well, this has been a really fascinating and important deep dive into a really complex issue. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, thank you for being here. We hope this conversation has encouraged you to think critically about the challenges and the possibilities in our legal system when it comes to protecting child witnesses and making sure there's justice for everyone.